You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, I'm joined by my special guests, Kathleen Burke and Martin Plaut, to discuss the day's top news stories. We'll look at Europe's refugee crisis. The UK is under pressure to take in more asylum seekers, and it's now tightening its English language requirements for immigrants. But the IMF is now saying refugees will be an economic boost for Europe. So will all xenophobes and detractors be proven wrong? Then Sarah Palin endorses Donald Trump. But do endorsements actually matter? We'll have that debate. All that, plus a diplomatic row between the US and Israel. We'll explore NATO's role in Eastern Europe. And then Davos. Is it worth it? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Martin Plaut and Kathleen Burke. Martin is a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, and Kathleen is Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL. And both of them, of course, are very regular voices here on Monocle 24. Welcome both to the show. Now, we're going to begin today with Europe's ongoing refugee crisis. At the moment, refugees are obliged to register in the first EU country that they enter. But it's not a system that's really being followed, with refugees landing often on beaches in the Med and then moving to countries such as Germany or even further north, such as Sweden, where technically they should have been allowed to register in that first country. The UK is at the moment allowed to deport asylum seekers, for example, if the UK is not the real point of first entry. But the EU is discussing changing all of this. In a way, Martin, it's just an acceptance of the reality, isn't it? That, you know, that it's impossible for, you know, if we're talking the numbers who came through Europe in the past 12 months, over a million people, if they have all been funneled up through Greece, the idea of, you know, trying to settle 1 million of them in Greece on tiny islands such as Lesbos is just purely ridiculous. Something has to give in this debate, isn't it?
Well, I agree, although one should bear in mind that somewhere like Lebanon, which has a population of 4.5 million, has actually 1 million refugees, and that's a tiny country caught between, you know, the mountains and the sea. So, you know, other people are doing it. I'm not suggesting that Greece should, but, you know, it's not impossible, but it is obviously extremely difficult, particularly given the precarious financial situation
but then the Greeks are in. I guess the interesting thing, that the way that the, you know, Europe is kind of built and the crisis has unfolded, is that the poorer countries are the ones who would be in the front line always. If you're,
they would, yes, absolutely. And of course, they really are just transit countries that people are using to then move on to richer countries. The big problem is that the solidarity that upon which Europe was built is really being tested now, and people are beginning to say, well, hang on, yes, we like the good bits, but this is not such a good bit. And, you know, do we really want to have all these people, and particularly the East Europeans, who have taken almost nobody, you know, or the, sort of what the former East Europeans, they're now, of course, Europeans, you know, they have rejected taking anybody. And Britain, of course, stands outside the whole system as well. So it's a very difficult problem for the whole of Europe.
Kathleen, what do you think about these suggested changes?
Well, it rather reminds me of in the village where I live, when there's now a proposal to bring 4,000 new houses there. You really don't want your way of life and your scenery and so forth changed. People don't like changes in that sense. And I think the problem here is, of course, obviously, difference in culture, and there's all the extra difficulty of so many young men, comparatively speaking. I like the IMF argument, which seems pretty obvious to me, that all of these refugees, if we forget about the changes in lifestyle, are going to be economically very good for Europe, that it will all lift the boat because more money will have to be spent on them, more money will have to be spent on building things, there'll be more production, there'll be more jobs, and on the whole, it will be a good thing rather than a bad thing. And of course, if it's a good thing, then people will get used to it. But it's going to be an awful couple of years.
But it's interesting, what you made a point at the beginning of that, which I think is interesting here. You know, the IMF, I think, are saying that this is going to be a small eventual kind of uptick in the economies of the countries who've taken the most migrants. but it isn't an uptick this year, and it isn't a huge number. It's a 0.something number.
0.3.
But what's interesting, you made that point about your village, and I think that what we've got to in many countries, as you were saying about Eastern Europe, for example, you've got to the point where people are saying, actually, do you know what? We're not so worried about that uptick in our economy if it's, 0.3% or even 1%. We're more worried about cultural aspects, whether rightfully or wrongly these people think that these new arrivals will change their culture in a way that they will not be happy with. And they're not willing to do that trade. That in the old days, you could perhaps say, even 2 or 3 years ago, you could say to people, it's great living in London. The number of people coming here from Poland, from Lithuania, they're changing your culture a little bit, but you just see the money running through your streets. Now people are, I wonder if there's a bit of a change in that cultural discussion.
Well, I think in London there isn't. I think we are at a point now where, quite frankly, nobody even notices who's sitting next to them on the buses or the tubes. I mean, it's just
London. Could be a neighbour, could be a tourist, could be.
Exactly. It's gone. That's gone. But in many of the German towns, which were quite homogeneous until recently, and were white Germans, to be frank, for all of a sudden have a load of Sudanese arriving is a massive surprise. And they just don't know how to deal with this. And the problem is not so much the numbers that have come so far, which is about 1 million, as you say, have come into Europe. But the IMF report assumes 1.3 million people continuing each year, and the United Nations High Commission for Refugees are assuming in their calculations 1 million people. So, this is an ongoing situation, and that I think the people of Europe will not accept. Under a crisis situation, yes, but as a continuing flow of people into Europe, without end, I think people will not.
So what will happen then? I mean, will there be uprisings amongst in the villages? Will everyone get voted out of office, and then there'll be the people will be rounded up and sent back? It's hard to know. I mean, I agree with you. It's going to be very tense. But when you try to start to think what they can actually do to get rid of these people now.
I think all of the above. And I think that we're already seeing it. 6 countries in Europe have already reimposed border restrictions. So the Schengen agreement, which allowed free access across Europe, is being torn up, even if it hasn't actually been torn up yet. So that is under threat. I think we're going to see NATO deployed in the Mediterranean, which it already is, to tackle human trafficking by attacking the boats that they would come on from the Libyan shore. We're going to see increased aid. We're going to see increased cooperation with security agencies in countries as unattractive as Sudan and Eritrea, which are absolute, not democracies. They are repressive regimes. And yet they are already in place, the mechanisms for all this to take place. So I think it is the most unattractive period that we're in, and the freedoms that we've enjoyed for so long are really seriously under threat.
It's just hard for me to imagine. I know Cologne quite well. My daughter's godfather is from there. And it's the idea of the Bundeswehr going out to the camps and going down the neighborhoods and rounding up all sort of North African looking men between the ages of 18 and 34. It's just hard to imagine.
I wonder though, Catherine, that in a way, maybe they don't have to do that. What's interesting is, if you take a longer term view, what happened with the former Yugoslavia and the republics that broke away from it. When the civil wars broke out there and the wars that broke out there, many people did go to Germany and they headed north for work and things. But actually, when peace returned to Croatia, to Serbia, many people actually, there was a, of course, many people did stay and started families, married Germans or Austrians or Italians, but many people did want to go back. And I wonder with Syria, at the moment, it's hard to imagine a peace deal that sticks. But if peace did come back to Syria, if there was a resolution, I wonder how many of those migrants might actually feel that their lives in the north were rather temporary, actually.
Well, I agree. I mean, any number of Syrian, especially young men or middle-aged men, they don't interview the women on this, have said that Syria is home, and when we can go back, we will. So families may well want to go back. I agree with you, those who are single come and establish new lives and so forth. But yes, I agree with you. I mean, if you were... No, we won't go down that road. But no, I agree that a lot of people don't want to be in the cold northern Europe. They want to go back land of sun and where they knew the area and know there, and they just want to go back to their country.
And it's also interesting, we paint this as a kind of dream journey if you get to the other end. But just looking at what's been happening in the UK today, there's a story about, they've been placing migrants in towns where then they've had this kind of ridiculous policy of painting their front doors red so that they could easily identify the houses that belong to this security company, which then, of course, unwittingly or wittingly made it very easy for people who were racist to, spot where the migrant lived. But what's interesting is when you look at the towns that those were in, impoverished towns, some of the poorest towns in the UK, where there is little or no opportunity, where people already feel kind of, that there is the central government has forgotten their needs and desires. Again, I wonder, is that a kind of almost deliberate policy to make sure that these people don't get too kind of secure in their new lives in the UK?
It could be. That's where the empty houses are.
Because I agree.
No one wants to go there because there's nothing to do, and so they can stick them in quickly.
But do you think, it's a difficult point, but Martin, do you think if you say to a migrant, come into our country, an asylum seeker, let's just stick with asylum seekers, if you come in as an asylum seeker, we recognise that you've had, you've been tortured, you've had a miserable life, and you've been in a camp for 2 years. Okay, welcome to the UK. We're going to send you to a town where there is no other Middle Eastern community, where there is poverty, and where we know that you will find it very, very difficult to fit in. But that will appeal to our voters because we daren't send you to London. Where in that balance is, I find it quite difficult to have the right answer, but what do you think that government should be doing?
Well, I don't think that is what's happening. I think what is happening is that people might be being put into places like this, but it's a misunderstanding to believe that people who are coming from even remote places, shall we say, like, I don't know, say Gambia or somewhere like that, and there are Gambians here, or from Cameroon, or, I happen to know the African case, that they don't know what they're getting into. This is not true, because people now have smartphones, even in remote areas, and they actually have connections across borders and across frontiers and transnational frontiers, a long way along. And people have a pretty good idea what they're going to get into when they cross their first border and how they're going to make that journey and what the situation is when they get to wherever it is, Leeds, Bradford, or wherever it is that they're going to be placed in, because they have connections with communities. And if they're dumped in a place which they find inhospitable, what they will do is very rapidly get in touch with their third cousin twice removed from the same village, who happens to be living in a different part of the UK, and say, what's it like? And they will say, oh, it's fine here. Come and leave, move. And people will just shift to wherever it is possible to make a living. So I think it is not that people are being dumped there and that's the end of the story. It is one part of a very long journey, because also these people are desperate to make money. They're desperate to get work because they have incurred huge debts to get there. Frequently, the whole village has clubbed round to pay for this journey. They are the repository and hope of their entire village or community, and they have to get work. They have to go where they can get it, and they will then make a go of things. So it's not quite the sort of the refugee with one shirt coming across the border. It's a more complicated story.
And just lastly, the other story that's surfaced today is that the UK wants to kind of make sure that everybody can speak English. This was a story that came out already for people who are living here, but there's now a migration question as well, that people must be able to pass a kind of certain level of English language skills to be brought into the country, or even brought in as a spouse to the country. Fair?
I think I find it quite interesting. I mean, Martin and I agreed before that anything that encourages people to learn a language or engage in any sort of education is a good thing, capital letters. Important there, two things. First of all, there have to be, obviously the government feels there must be some sort of sanction, because otherwise why would anyone take the time and energy to learn a new language? But it seems to me the sanction is on the male, because if we're looking at females, one gathers that it can be very difficult for the women to go out the house and go to the school and so forth, at least for a substantial number. But if the man feels he's going to lose his housekeeper, his wife, his helpmate, because she's going to be sent back, he'll be more encouraged, one hopes. The other thing is that it's spouse. It's not wife. And so therefore, perhaps all of these young men who have been brought over to marry the daughter of the house, because it's from the same village, will also have to learn English or he'll get turfed out. So I don't object when it if it's evenly applied.
Well, we're going to move on to a very different story now. We're going to head
just,
to the...
Just before we do, can I just tell you one quick joke?
Oh, yeah, yeah. As long as it's a good joke about migration, interrupting my next joke, my next story, but go for it.
It's just the idea, there was a cartoon which showed Brits in Spain saying that if this law was applied to the Brits in Spain, 95% of them would be sent home. They can't speak Spanish.
Yeah, I think there's probably a million of those in Spain. As well, as I said, though we're bouncing across another kind of period, space of water to the U.S. now, where Sarah Palin yesterday endorsed Donald Trump in his bid to become the Republican nomination for president. What do we make of the idea of Sarah Palin and what the value of her nomination, Kathleen?
Well, values depend on who's looking at it. I mean, those of us who find her somewhat difficult to come to terms with don't see the value. Ted Cruz saw the value. He was very upset that she decided to go for Trump. He says that her endorsement and so forth helped him win his Senate seat. If you think it matters, then it's valuable. And obviously, people who get endorsements think it matters. Now, on the other hand, I think it matters if someone whom I respect writes a book review about a book and says it's really good, I'm inclined to go look at it. Now, that's an endorsement, the same sort of thing. If Bono says, let's do this, I can't tell you how much I don't care. In the sense, that depends. There's a significant demographic in the United States that thinks Sarah Palin walks on water. And her endorsement of Donald J. Trump will matter for him and for them, because that presumably will solidify at least a demographic that will not go to Cruz but will stay with him. And he needs this in Iowa because Cruz has pulled ahead.
And is that, just before we bring in Martin, is that the key thing? So it's not that, you know, it points to him as being a key figure or anything. It's more that she can deliver a certain constituency to him when the voting happens.
Well, I think so. Otherwise, why would anyone bother? He is on the crux right now. The Iowa primary is on the 1st of February. Just a couple weeks' time. Cruz is inching ahead, and obviously Trump feels that her endorsement will make the difference. The way he was, I looked at it on the BBC website, in fact, and watched part of this, and the way he was beaming was really almost embarrassing. He obviously could hardly believe his luck.
Martin, when we look at Sarah Palin, when we look at Mr. Trump here, for Europe, for people outside the US, it's been quite hard to get our heads around the appeal, because he doesn't fit into the kind of normal European kind of politician, maybe a little bit, you know, outspoken, like a Berlusconi in a way, but he doesn't really have a European equivalent. So we get a bit lost in kind of analysing him, and we certainly get lost in analysing Sarah Palin, because, you know, we only know her for her gaffes and her kind of her misspoken
There's
words.
There's another part to her, is there?
Well, as Kathleen's saying, she can walk on water as far as many voters. There is a huge number of Americans who find what goes on in Washington, the world of elected politicians and professional politicians, they despise it. And I think she, like Trump, represents that voice who just doesn't like big government. But do you think that she is going to be a valuable source of support for him?
Well, I presume that she will be. Otherwise, he wouldn't have, been such a beaming Cheshire cat when he was presented with this little gift. But I mean, listen, I can't even understand his hairstyle, let alone his politics. But I mean, she is just an extraordinary figure. I mean, didn't she talk about President Obama as being, instead of being the commander in chief, but the commander of capitulation in this endorsement speech? And, you know, and I think it was the Christian Science Monitor that pointed out that both are walking streaks of bluster. So, I mean, they walk in step with each other in this. But in a way, I can understand where all this comes from, because if you think about the way in which Europeans, and particularly Brits, now view Europe And everything that Europe is doing is bad. This is big government. This is interference in our lives. And if you think about the United States, not as a nation, but as a collection of states, individual states that happen to have come together, the United States, right? I mean, the clue is in the title. That really, the authentic voice of America is in the individual states. And yes, they come together occasionally over some issues. There is an element of that that you can sort of see a parallel between Washington and Brussels. I don't know, Pep, I don't know whether you would agree.
No, I think that's a good point, because I was just going to say what's interesting is when you look at that debate in Europe, we were talking about this, you know, the idea of, you know, economy versus migration. I think it's the same in the US, that many people think, actually, I don't care if no Muslims come in here, if it kind of, you know, protects us, makes us feel safe, even if it dents our economy. They're not choosing on purely economic lines. There's a cultural thing here that, again, if you're not American and if you're not from, you know, outside of the big metropolitan areas, do you think that when you talk to Europeans here, Kathleen, about your home nation, that people just don't quite understand that other America that isn't New York, that isn't LA, that isn't Miami?
Well, since I come from part of that is to say California, and there's no doubt you're quite right, the eastern and western seaboards are much different from all the big everything in the middle. They think very differently. I was in Iowa in November for a family occasion, in fact, and these incredibly wonderful, extremely friendly Midwesterners, they're going to be voting for Trump. And I think possibly when you're there, there's no real... they're out there. I mean, America grew up with, look, moats on either side, Canada and Mexico and the North and the South. These are not threats. Now, if you think there is a threat, if you think that from the South, for example, coming, you know, immigrants, or somehow Iran is going to fire a missile at you or whatever, you start getting worried and you start saying, we're going to batten down the seaboards. And I think when I grew up in California sometime in the last century, if you paid attention to politics at all, it was local politics. If something really important was happening, you might look to the state capital, but you almost never looked to Washington. People in Europe do not realize the distances. San Francisco to New York is London to Damascus. And it has, in many respects, the same differences in cultures. And that's something... Britain is such a unified country, relatively speaking, that they cannot understand America being so disunited, because France and Germany aren't very united, are they? And Italy doesn't get along with Belgium quite that much.
Well, interesting stuff. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Madrid House here with me, Andrew Tuck, and also with Martin Plough and Kathleen Burke. And we're all back right after this.
Monocle has Bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Singapore, our bureau chief is Nolan Giles.
I think the most exciting thing about being based here in Singapore during this period of such rapid growth for Southeast Asia is the energy of the professional community here. So you have this Singaporean mindset of ambition and of hard work and of punching well above its weight, mixed with a community of people from outside the country that have come here to add more depth, to bring their knowledge, to bring their culture and their understanding.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Madrid House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Martin Plout and Kathleen Burke. Now, ever since Vladimir Putin began his saber-rattling in recent years, NATO and the alliance's future have been a hot topic of discussion. Well, this week, the president of Poland has called on NATO to make its presence in Poland as permanent as possible to protect against invasion from Russia. Martin, significant? What's happening here?
Well, I think it is significant. It is vitally important that the Russians get the message, and that once you're a member of NATO, you're not going to disappear and become just, you know, a candidate for, as shall we say, you know, somewhere like Georgia. I mean, I was in Georgia a couple of years ago, and their feeling of having the Russians sort of nibbling away at their territory was really an ongoing one. And if you were sitting in Poland, you would definitely want to have the assurance of 100% guarantee from NATO. And it's either 100% or it's nothing. Because in the end of the day, somewhere like the guarantee is extraordinary. I mean, if you think about it, under the guarantee, the United States is saying we will sacrifice, if necessary and if push comes to shove, we will sacrifice New York and Washington for Warsaw. We would go up to and including full nuclear war in order to protect our NATO allies. It's a fantastic agreement and one that, you know, is amazing. Now, of course, the point is that the Russians don't know whether they really would be prepared to go down it. But that fear and that lack of certainty is why NATO is such an important guarantee for all these countries, especially the ones on the rim.
Yeah, but we find, Kathleen, Mr. Putin mercurial at the best of times. What point is there to the argument that actually you ramp up all of these kind of, you know, military systems and send in NATO troops all along the border with Russia? That is the thing that got Russia incredibly concerned about NATO troops going into Ukraine. In many ways, may have been part of they felt the provocation. Is it what point does it become protection and what point does it become provocation, do you think?
That depends on the balance of strength, doesn't it? I agree with Martin. Russia has to know that something will happen. Uncertainty is very bad in international relations. One of the great things about the Cold War is that the balance meant that both the USSR and the United States knew that there was limits to what they could do, which is why we had proxy wars all over the globe. But you knew you could depend, so that there's not that dependency now. You don't know what Putin is going to do. And therefore, you have to keep hold of nurse for fear of finding something worse. At least as much as having tanks run over the border, it's going to be cyber warfare. They've already tried to wipe out Latvia in that way. And I think Poland's defenses really ought to include ramping up her ability to keep carpet bombing from various massed computers from Russia at least as important as anything. But I agree with Martin. They have to respond. They have to respond, because if once Russia thinks that NATO won't respond. Could I say one interesting thing about this in terms of you've got the Polish government fighting with the EU over things like control of media and so forth, and then you've got the Polish government insisting with NATO that you have to protect us. And the difference between that is the United States. Poland has to keep the U.S. on side. The rest of it can go, but Poland has to keep the U.S. So they can fight with France and Germany over media control and control of justice, but not the U.S.
Well, apologies. We're not going to get all the stories in today because we've been diving deeper into these topics. But we will quickly go to the idea of Davos, which is happening at the moment high up in the Alps, the World Economic Forum. Martin, do you watch these events and what comes out of it with interest? Do you think it's a valuable meeting of people, or is it just a wealthy club which actually is more about exclusion than inclusion?
I think it's just candy floss. I mean, can you remember one thing that happened two Davoses ago?
No,
nor can I. So what the
But that doesn't mean much. My brain is not that good.
I defy anyone to remember.
Wasn't it one Davos sometimes? I may be misremembering, where Bill Gates announced they were going to have this huge charity to save the world healthily.
But wouldn't he have done it anyway at some stage? It's just a fancy place for people to make whatever remarks they want to make in any case. I don't think it's a hape of the beans, except for the leaders themselves. Quite useful to swap information and
you meet in corridors.
Exactly, the informal stuff.
But isn't that the nature of many of these events? In the end, I wonder, the importance isn't the event, it's the conversations that happen in corridors and off-site.
Sure, we're never going to find out about them.
Sounds like academic conferences. Don't go to the seminars. Just go to the coffee
room. Absolutely.
Well, I've got a feeling when we leave this room, we will not find Kathleen's snow boots or Michael's skis waiting in the lobby for them as they leave. So. But that's all we're going to have time for on today's show. It was produced by Danny Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Eugenia Derez. And our studio manager was Chris Chovas. And of course, my star guests were Martin Plaut and Kathleen Burke. For the next half hour, it's Monocle's international playlist with some great tunes for you to listen to there. Then at 1900 hours, Danny is back again, this time with his show, The Entrepreneurs. So if you have a startup, if you have an SME that you want to grow and get going, he's the man to listen to. This show will be back, of course, at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck, and thank you very much for listening indeed. Bye-bye.